the purpose of holding forums is an important one. We think it provides for a unique opportunity for conversation on typically important topics, and tonight is an important topic. And it's really a unique opportunity, as you know, to just listen to one another and learn to listen to one another. And especially on the topics we've had over the last few weeks that I've been here, when between terrorism and the Clinton-Lewinsky matter, and it was a very interesting forum to just let people talk, and that's what we do here. Tonight, obviously, it's a much more lighthearted kind of perspective, but important nonetheless, because I've been here now about a month and a half, and I'm new to Holden. And I realize now that, and I've worked in many different institutions, and there's really, because of the volunteer nature of Holden over the years, there's very little institutional memory. The memory truly is with you folks that have been here over the years. And it really makes, you know, your involvement and continued involvement so important for the continuation of Holden. Tonight, we would just like to hear some stories of your experiences, your remembrances, anything along those lines. It kind of was sparked by the fact that we're going into Miners Weekend, and I'm really delighted to be here for this weekend. It's a weekend obviously steeped in the history of the Holden Valley, with all the miners coming in and the programs and the information they bring. So there'll be a lot of storytelling and stories to be heard all weekend, and I'm really looking forward to it. And along those lines, we are, by the way, throughout the weekend, we'll be doing a couple different things to begin to preserve some of our stories, your stories. Very specifically, one thing we're doing is we're going to have a table in the dining hall starting tomorrow. We would like you to take the opportunity, get a cup of coffee or whatever, sit down at the table, and write out your story. A story, a remembrance, a recollection about the past and about your Holden experience. And there'll be a box there, we're going to collect them, and we're going to have them transcribed, and we'll collect them and preserve them. And if you put your name and information, we really hope you do, we will somehow document that, and that'll be preserved here at Holden. Another thing we're looking forward to doing is just collecting oral histories throughout the weekend. We have a couple people who have are interested in doing that, and as people we discover that have a real history with Holden, we're going to set them up with an interview so that they can, their oral history be collected, as well as we'll have videotape sessions if that works out too. So those are two things that we're going to work on to kind of preserve some of this wonderful history we have here for this weekend. Tonight, in terms of our format, I was thinking about how to start this, and I thought one way we could do it is start with the oldest story that's in this room that somebody can tell, and then maybe work our way from there. So, anybody want to throw out some?
I have a 1961.
A 1960. This is the highest bidder so far. Can you beat that? Story from the Holden Valley or anything? Bob.
1941.
I think you won, Tom. There, Bob, excuse me. Why don't you go right ahead, and if you could, would you like to stand up or and tell your story? And
very well. I hitchhiked 8 times across the United States in the 30s and early 40s, and was invited to come out from the state of Maine to Seattle, Washington, which I had never heard of, and do some apple knocking. Successfully negotiated the hitchhiking tour in 6 days and started working for the Wenatchee B.D. Orchard Company, along with 4 other college students from the East Coast, And at that time, when they had forest fires up in the Stehekin area, they would kidnap 10% of the workers on the ranches. By that, they asked for volunteers, more or less like that. And but we were rather young and whippersnappers, and we wanted to volunteer for it, so we thought it would be an exciting time. And we were taken in an open boat, a motor, upward motor boat, by the Forest Service up to Stehekin, where for the rest of the summer we would fight fires coming down on the west side toward Holden, on the east side, whatever you call the town, or Douglas County perhaps, something like that, or Waterville area. But all in all, it was quite an exciting experience. We were paid the big, big sum of 35 cents an hour, but only while on the trail. And there were, along with us, some older folks from Skid Road in Seattle who used to come and do the apple knocking in the summertime. There were incidentally many, many people that were riding the rails in those days. We could count those that were hanging on for dear life or else sleeping to try to sleep under the undercarriages of the freight trains going on up. But they did have a rough time on the trail. Whenever the ranger would say take five, the rangers would be just about like this, marking time in one spot, and we young whippersnappers would emulate them. But those fellows from Skid Road would just fall down and fall asleep in 1 minute, and 5 minutes later they had to get up and get on the trail. And there were any number of heart attacks from those fellows. But that was the Holden experience, if you want to call it an experience in this neck of the woods in 1941.
What does take five mean?
Take five minutes. Oh, I know what you're thinking of.
Was
before this day.
Oh, okay.
And what was apple knocking?
Yeah.
Apple knockers?
Picking.
Yeah, jelly thinners. We used to have to spray trees with a lead arsenic. And some of these fellows did not like that because it was rather relatively poisonous. But in the 30s, any kind of a job was, as you all know, was essential. Yeah. And so it didn't faze us at all to have the lead arsenic come down. But you would either spray the trees or you would thin the trees later on. Yeah. Thin them, nowadays it's done almost chemically in a way. The strongest bud survives out of the spray, out of a cluster. But we have to take it out by hand, climb up the trees and
separate. There's a lot of hand work done out there.
It used to be.
I see them doing it.
Bob, could you do one thing and introduce, we're taping this session, and this is one of the ways we'll preserve the stories here. Could you introduce yourself and tell me where you're from again?
Bob Rice from Bremerton, Washington.
Thank you, Bob.
I'm Elmer Witt from Tacoma, Washington. I was around at the beginning of Holden, after, of course, West Creek, by all means, and shrewd lay people from the Seattle area who, after the church said they didn't want to get involved with Holden because no one would ever come here, these lay people said, no, this is going to work. And they were the ones who put it together. There's always, as you know, when any good thing happens, hundreds of people that really deserve the credit. And the laymen from Seattle were just great. I came up early. I was executive director of the Walford Inn, the youth program of the Missouri Synod. And my predecessor had organized the youth directors of all the churches, Lutheran churches at that time. You know, there were, seems like there were about 400. I think there were 12. At that time, and we got together regularly, and it was Merton Scrumman who learned from Wes and Bill Bird about this place, so some of us came up to take a look at it. They wanted us to invest money in it because it was going to be a young adult center, and we were responsible for young adult ministry, so we came. Of course, that was before anybody had fixed it up. It was after it had been lying here vulnerable to everything that happens to the animals around here, and I do mean human ones, that came and raided the place and stole the silverware and bedding and everything else from the place and did lots of damage to the place. Windows broken all over the place. There was a movie projector way back in the upper room in the village center that was also damaged, and they said, some bear must have crawled up there. It was a human that went up there with a piece of metal and smashed the machine. It is terrible. But how you got here is on the back of the truck, of course. And I remember it was Dave Brown, former bishop in Iowa, and I were in the back. And when it came, those trucks didn't make the swings on the switchback. So it means they pulled up and then backed out. And you looked down, and you were hanging over the edge. I wasn't sure we were ever going to come here again after that scary trip. A couple other things from the early days. And we traveled back and forth. Before there were any buses here, you came in and went out on a truck. We all stood up in the truck for the 30, 40 mile a minute trip down, well, it was even longer than that, going down down the hill. And often, if you were here when there was a crowd, you were just crunched together. Your luggage was on another truck, and you were just standing there going down, hauling people out, hauling people in. It was great fun. Unique person, of course, among many, was Carol Hinderly, the first full-time director. Gil Berg was the mayor of Holden and inspirational leader of it, and certainly benefactor of the village. But Carol Hinderly is crazy. I think about the nicest thing he can say. Just a marvelous man. He would, whoever it was, he'd pick up the phone and call the person, any person in the world, and they'd say, you ought to come. And then they would come. And of course, then he imagined everything, and he would rarely tell you in advance. If you arrived at noon, he'd say, well, Elmer Witt's in the village, and tonight he's leading Vespers at 7:30. I didn't know he was leading Vespers at 7:30. So it's a strange and crazy and marvelous person. And so focused on the gospel of Jesus Christ that he really made the place be lots what it is. You cannot have Holden without someone like Carol Hinderly. But since I doubt there is anybody like Carol Hinderly, it's fair to say you really need him. He kept he had been in youth ministry too for the American Lutheran Church, and he did not want this ever to become a Bible camp, because for him, Bible camp, although he had sponsored them, was not a good word phrase. It was a very rigid, narrow-minded point of view that he resisted. And so, if you wanted to irritate him, you would say, well, I'm glad to be here at your Bible camp. And of course, he goes to the ceiling. So once when he goes out, there was a sign out here at the entrance to Holden Village, and of course, we covered it up with Holden Bible Camp. So when he came back here, we renamed the village. And anything goes, in a very good sense, anything goes with him. He, his office in the dining hall up here, his wife was up in Chalet 9. He'd get on the amplifying system for the whole village and say, Mary, can you bring me down some cigars? Crazy thing. And of course, he believed in the law, gospel, and the sauna. I think there were means of grace. I'm not sure that he believed that all of them were, but he spent a lot of time in there, and had a good sense of humor. We had one of the things a lot of us who were here remember is we had a nightclub one night over in the Village Center. We had topless dancing by men. people were doing line dance and everything else. And some of the very, very wonderful people, but very rigidly theological people, were very upset about that and offended by it. I'd say they were offended. And of course, we're not very careful about that, which all you had to do is, you know, spark his creativity and stubbornness. So the next morning, he came to breakfast to lead matins wearing a clerical collar and a Playboy t-shirt. His toughest lie that I recall, and I think this has been exacerbated by enough people that it isn't just my memory, and he said to them, he says, "When you act the way you did last evening, I believe that your God is my devil." That's pretty tough stuff.
Yeah.
But again, he was unafraid. You know, he had been prisoner of war, captured. It wasn't the Philippines or where?
Philippines.
And where he was in one camp and Mary, his wife, was in the other camp, pregnant with his first child. And he could not be with her. She had the child over there and he was over here. His hands wavered a lot, even from way, way back. Just a great man. And his wife, made Carol possible. First woman theologian I met. She had already written articles in the Christian Century, I think in the 40s. That's pretty early for women being leaders in that thought. And still is today. To visit her front room in, what's the name of the town?
Stockholm,
Wisconsin. And to see the books on her coffee table is an education all in itself. You could take a course in her front room from the books, the best of past or present. It's just a marvelous woman. And she would so politely correct Carol when he was when he'd be off his track for some reason or the other, and "Oh, Carol," and then she'd say something that, well, then he would agree with her about it. And he would lead endless Bible studies. And he would just say, "We'll get together to discuss whatever it be." Well, there was no discussion with Carol. It was a stream of consciousness Bible study that would go, you know, and if it was a 50-minute or an hour assignment, hour and a half later, he said, "Oh, well, we're over," you know, but he would have talked for an hour and a half. Not allowing for any, he couldn't interrupt, couldn't get in. And I was on the early board, and once, totally disorganized, you know. He originated disorganization. He didn't like the board. Not the members of the board. He didn't like boards. Well, I guess he didn't like authority. And he would get real upset about the board that's going to meet. And he would be stewing about it. You know, we had caused problems and stuff. And we were dealing with him at the time because he was really focused on the programming of the village. And there was somebody else who was supposed to be doing the business end of the village. And of course, he would, free-spirited, he'd do business stuff as well and sometimes get the village into debt. So we're meeting as a board to try to figure that out, and excused him and the other person out of the room. And we're trying to figure a way to get that across to him. While he was excused out of the room, he met somebody in the village and bought about $4,000 worth of pipe. Neither he or anyone else knew what they would do with it. And I think when we called them back, we just prayed and left. You have to recognize hopeless causes, right? Another time we came and the meeting was pretty disastrous. We had traveled, we traveled up here, we didn't always, but we did. It was a long way to come. I came from Chicago and other people around the country. And it was a mess and we were really eager to leave. And then that doggone guy did a closing devotion that we lived off of for about 3 months. He was so good and so in Jesus Christ that you hung on to it. Great man, a great man. And hilarity was his signal and his gift in many ways. When anybody starts worrying about all the new liturgies and stuff like that, I said, well, if you weren't at Holden early on, just wait. You ain't seen nothing yet. I don't remember any church I've seen other than Holden, a woman in leotards dancing on the altar. That's early years at Holden. And it fit. Everything that was working, it worked. Like tonight's service is so well put together. But in a different spirit, there was another thing happened that ended up in dancing all over the village. And it was nothing snorted or anything like that. It was just, well, probably what the psalmists did, you know, and certainly wrote about. And that happened here as well. The marks on my family and on my kids, and you're seeing the evidence of one of them while you're here, my son Tom, are just long lasting. Not all my kids are in the church, but they bear the mark of Holden and just loads of people that have come through this place. I'm going to stop there. It just embarrassed me because when you've been a director, you're asked to do a oral history of the time you were here. I have about a 10-page outline on my desk. The longest one is the dumb things I did while director. But I have to.
All right. Keep working on it.
Go back.
Can I just add one thing about?
Yeah, I would love to hear.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but since we're at a forum, I remember it may be the only forum that was ever stopped at home, but he stopped a forum once when somebody who was, I think, rather conservative was presenting, arguing an unpopular viewpoint, and someone else started making fun of him and insulting him.
Yes.
And Carol stopped the forum and he said, that doesn't happen at Holden.
Yes.
And he ended the forum.
Yes. And he apologized to the people that he said that about God and the devil to. Mm-hmm. He did do that. But he was venting what he really believed when he said it. But that's something he should have said in private and worked out. Mm-hmm. But he did respect the people's feelings. And that carried on. And that was a gift of dear Mary as well.
And that voice is Tom Witt, yeah. Elmer's son. Tom, I'd love to hear your stories at the same time. I'm sure you were here in the village and growing up.
I don't have any long stories. I just have, you know, little snippets of memories of playing in the mine. which wasn't closed off.
Oh, wow.
So the kids were just all over there.
Mm-hmm.
I must have had in my room at home in Chicago probably, you know, 80 of those ore samples.
Up or in did you go?
Well, legally, we never went in the mine, but in the mine buildings that are the mill, yeah, is where we played. And then people obviously went into the mine, but that was not.
We really got in as far as one of the large rooms, I remember.
Is there a story about a possum, that you caught a possum in there?
I went in as far as the porcupine.
Oh, you did? Oh.
Please, sure.
I think my first memory was when I brought my kids up as a single mother at the Schramm years.
Could you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Mary Ann Sakamoto.
Great, thank you.
And in those days, they didn't have the minors and the junior minors and any organization for the kids, but the kids organized themselves. And every year, they would tell their parents that they had to come the third week in August or whatever it was. So we all had to sign up at the same time right after the first of the year. So we'd all get there on the same week. So the kids would meet each other. And they have formed lasting friendships from that. And the other crazy thing that I remember was Herb Brokering, who I think is an incredibly genius guy, but wild and crazy also.
Yes.
And he engineered some kind of a Renaissance festival where we processed up to the new Sundun Lumber Spa. And we were all in the draperies, curtains, and made these tall hats and things. Hikers coming from out of the woods. This crazy group playing the violins and things and processing up to the sun that thought they had gone to some really nutty outfit. So those are some of my memories.
I wondered where that Renaissance Festival came from. I walked in on that. So we're kind of,
I should tell you about my first night ever in the village in 1965. I got routed out of bed, and what happened, Merton Irene Strumman's youngest boy was supposed to be in bed. He snuck out, and to not wake up his parents, he climbed up the drain pipe on Chalet 9, and then separated from the house. He broke his arm.
You didn't identify yourself, sir.
I'm Phil Dean. I'm on the teaching staff this time. Was on the special staff before. I'm a pediatrician, and so I was, every time we came here, I was a village doctor. And it looks like it has continued.
No way.
Early.
I'm Grace Lark from Marysell, and I brought some letters up that my dad had written to me and his family, who worked here as an electrician helper in 1938.
Wow.
And he had been raised as a Lutheran. And so it's a real tie-up for me.
It's great. You're welcome. Thanks.
Are you going to read your letters?
Well, I can't. I've left them at the registers. Quite involved. They explain in detail a lot of wonderful things.
We'd love to get reproductions of them. If you can stop at the program office, we could make copies and then make them available for people to read.
I've done that with you.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Okay. They can copy them if they want.
Oh, they got them. Okay. Thank you very much.
1938. My question is there such a thing as a list of when he would have come in and when he would have left?
Have you been up to the museum? A museum curator will be here this weekend. You should check with him. His name is Rick Dunning.
And we'll be gone.
Oh, you're going to leave?
Thanks.
Well, we'll ask for you. Let us know, and we'll ask for you.
Yeah. You can leave your name with me, and we'll ask, and we'll get some response from Rick. He's pretty familiar with what's up there.
I have some.
Great.
I can't date back to the 60s or 40s or 30s or anything. I'm Dana Massey. I'm 19, and from Portland, Oregon. And I've grown up most of my life at home. Ever since I was 4 years old, my family would come up in the summertime for about 2 weeks and visit Holden. And I can remember as a little kid coming up here and, you know, running around with the video camera, chasing all the chipmunks and the deer. And then I can remember my first hike was up Huntington Heights. And I don't know how old I was, but we got up to the third level and I was with some friends. I don't remember any friends, but I was with some friends and I had a loose tooth. It was my first tooth and I lost it up on the third level. And I can remember, I came out, I bit down on something and it came out and it fell. And I was shocked. I had to find that tooth. It was my first tooth. I had to find it. You know, the color of the tan lanes and the tooth mixed in with that. I searched and finally found my tooth up on the tan lanes, you know, mixed with all this tan lanes dust. Oh, with my tooth in the middle of tan lanes dust. Some other things I remember. We used to go over by the river when there were a ton of fish in the Railroad Creek. And my brother and my dad used to go fishing. And when we first started coming here, my brother was only one. And my mom, and to keep track of him so he wouldn't run to the river, she would tie him to the trees near the sauna with a rope. It would go out just to the, you know, just so he could get to where we were next to the river and stick his fishing pole in and sit down on the side of it, you know, 1 or 2 years old with this little fishing pole, you know, fishing in Railroad Creek. Of course, a plastic hook, you know, about 2 inches long. And trying to catch fish, and my mom would tie him to the trees and make sure that he didn't get into any trouble. Of course, like a dog, he'd tangle himself through all of the trees around the
Thank you, Dana. That's a great story. And please, you know, I'll tell my history of Holden. It started 6 weeks ago. That was the first time we came into the village. I remember coming up on the bus. That was only 6 weeks ago. So my history is probably the shortest of most people. It's still very worthwhile.
I think I'm Patricia Labors, and I'm here on long-term staff now, but I haven't been here 31 years. And I think when you talk about short but meaningful histories, I was here in 1967 for 6.5 days. And Holden made an impression on me that I carried with me for a really long time. I don't know if I have any one particular memory of it. It just became such a part of me. It meant more to my little 12-year-old heart and soul than I can think of anything else in the past. And as I come down to a point of transition in my life, the last couple of years kept bringing Holden back in. I hadn't been here all that time, but I always wanted to come back here and live and work. And so even with such a short stay, it really connects people. And it's amazing how many times, as I would bring up the name of Holden throughout my travels, that people would have a connection. They're just connected everywhere.
Our first, I'm Marion Yonhas from Bellingham, Washington. Our first experience with Holden was the last year that you were here, Elmer, which was like 11 years ago, and we came up for Christmas. And the bombardier picked us up down at the dock. Of course, there was a lot of snow, like there always is. And you pile yourself into this bombardier, which only holds, I don't know, 6 people or something like that. And then there's all these sacks of potatoes and sacks of carrots and all of this that they pile in. And and all your luggage and everything, most of it goes on top. But anyway, everything is all jammed in. You're sitting there hanging out of this 100-pound bag of potatoes all the way up. I don't know what was wrong with this bombardier. I don't think any bombardier really works well. It took us twice as long to get up here, and it just kept. He couldn't get into another deer, and then it would stop. I think some of the what are these things that
Tracks.
The tracks kept falling off the wheels, and I thought, what is this all about? And Chuck loves chocolate chips, and I don't know, maybe it was fate, but he had this big 25-pound sack of chocolate chips. And he swears that the top was already ripped. All the way up, he kept eating chocolate chips. And he never lived that down. The cooks kept slipping chocolate chips into his oatmeal, you know. And after we got home, some of the guests here were sending him good care packages with chocolate chips and instant oatmeal. It was just a riot. It was really, really funny. And then that same holiday, we were living up here, because this is one of the, you know, this and the hotel are the only two places that they house guests. And there are a big, huge, beautiful Christmas tree goes up in here. And the young people, they were ready to go out to get one, and they announced, any guests that want to go with us, you know, you're welcome to come. Well, we had our cross-country ski, so all right, we'll go with you. I mean, we're going to go out and hunt a tree. Great, Scott. This is great fun. Well, it was really great fun going down the road, but then they cut off into the woods. I mean, you don't get trees on the road. And they took off. And they were on snowshoes, and they were really great with skis. I mean, Chuck and I are chugging along. And I turned off, we both turned off, and somewhere along the line, I fell in a hole. I fell down. I just fell down. And the snow is really, really deep. I mean, you fall down, and it's death, because you're completely covered with snow. My skis were, the only thing I could see in my skis were the tips, and I'm laying there, and I'm screaming and yelling, and Chuck is nearby, and I said, help me get up, help me get out of this snow. And he says, if I come over and help you, I'm going to fall down, and we're both going to be down in the snow. And these kids were, I don't know, they seemed to be miles away. Nobody was hearing me scream or anything. So I finally got myself up to a bush, got myself back on my feet, and Chuck was standing there looking at me. I think he was praying the whole time. And I mean, all I could think of is when I laid down there, is that when spring came along, I'm going to find this body of bones and wonder who belongs to those skis. You know, that's what I thought. I would never live through this. So we finally got on our feet, went a few feet, and here this group is over there. And they're laughing at us. And I'm saying, why didn't you come and rest? Well, we would have come if you really couldn't get out. So they found this huge, I don't know, 30-foot tree. And I'm hearing this sawing, looking around, saying, yeah, where is the person who's sawing this tree? And I look, go up to the tree, and the well, you know, the tree sit in these wells. I mean, the snow was so deep, it was over this guy's head. And he's down there with his saw going, you know, the snowman. And when the tree fell, it didn't even fall. It just leaned on the snow. And then we pulled it out, and then the bombardier came down and pulled it on in. And I thought, boy, never again will I accept an invitation to cut down a tree. Not
at
home. It's hard to get up with 100 pounds of potatoes on you.
Yeah.
Oh, I had a cursed laugh.
I'm Ryan Dresden from Scottsdale, and I want to add a couple things to what Elmer said and to what Tom said, too, because they were here at some times. And whether you were lucky with Carol giving you a whole half day for Westford. The first time I was here, I had no idea, you know, as usual, what to expect. And I came up and, you know, trusting him and all these things. And at breakfast, Carol said, Irving Jor said, at 8:30, we'll talk on. And that was my first announcement. That was my first day. And then, now, of course, we heard Bishop Lowell Erdahl came once, and Carol was gone until Monday, and this was on Saturday when Lowell was here. And he said, Erling, what am I supposed to talk about? And I said, well, what was your latest book? And you said, on homiletics. And he said, well, I think you could try that. Of course, Carol right away picked up on that and said that was fine, so Lowell got along just fine. But if Carol were the inspiration, and there's no question about that, the glue was Werner Jansen and Terence Drum. Absolutely. Werner knew where everything was. If you needed a half gallon of some varnish or something, it's under Chalet 4. Had an incredible, you know, memory of all these things. And once he had his own little speedboat, and the nearest telephone was at 25 mile, and I wasn't teaching that day, so he said, come along for, you know, for somebody to talk with. And he went down, and I saw how he worked. We had all the invoices of Wells and Woodbridge. Is that the name of the...
Wayne.
Yeah, whatever, the hardware store in Wayne and Wenatchee and all these things. And Karen was just as gifted, keeping all the records and doing all these things. And she made a virtue out of necessity with a long winter night. She started studying astronomy. And she got so enthused about astronomy that when some kind of spectacular event was going to happen, and you could see it best in, was it Australia or New Zealand? Mm-hmm. That's where she went for her vacation. There's so many things like this. And the other one, well, two things. One, nobody does 4th of July like Holden. This was the bicentennial, right? And I think you, Elmer, had that sort of headdress that the Statue of Liberty had.
I still have it.
You still have it, right. And you were very proud of it. They had the parades, and who was it? Rich Kamer had gotten some of these paint suits that professional painters wear, sort of not a cloth, not a paper, but in between. And we all had these for our band uniforms. And then we rehearsed back and forth for a long time, and we had kitchen band, and we had Werner was the drum major, and then we had two people dressed up as George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. It was Paul Bosch, is that his name? Paul, the economist, Paul somebody.
Paul Hayne.
Paul Hayne, yeah. And then Al Pitcher looked like George Washington. And they stood on the upper balcony here over at the D.C. and gave, you know, orations. And then we had the parade. And then that night, it was, Kamer went on with his light show. I've never seen anything like that in my life. He was leaning over the projector here, and he would have cut glass and showing, you know, images and things, and he went on and on. But nobody wanted to, you know, to quit. And I thought another hype was that we had Leo Bustet from Washington State University here. He was one of the, you know, the important people, and he came out. And the place was dark, and all of a sudden he pushed a button, and his bow tie came on, and red light. I think it was 14 lessons on how to get along in life. I remember Leo was very good on those things. So the other one was with the Shrams, John and Mary were out for a while, and it was this crazy Dan Erlander got us organized. And when they came back, we were all standing where the bus, you know, where the bus discharges people, and we all had sort of sheets over our head, and with a little sort of tire on these things. All we said was grace, grace, grace. John and Mary got off the bus. That's all we said, nothing else on this thing. For about an hour, we went around these disembodied spirits just saying grace. They don't come like that anymore.
What was Dan Erlander's fatal announcement at dinner?
Oh, no.
Is that public?
I was driving, and John Schramm was driving, and somebody else was driving, and we discovered there was no one, the village discovered there was no one to make announcements. And Dan, as the village pastor, was sort of the next in charge, I guess. And so Karen went down to the kiosk to write down everything that was going to be going on in the afternoon, and meanwhile Dan was having to fumble around, find out who was leaving, because at that time it was at lunch that you said goodbye to people before to get on the bus. And so after fumbling around, they announced all the names who were leaving, and he said, now let's all give these people a round of the Holden clap. Came in to be village pastor, Larry Rasmussen, who was the program director, had found a book that in the front, Dan's name was in it from the library as having checked it out the previous year, and there was writing in the margins. There was pencil writing, and they didn't know if it was Dan's, but they were quite sure that it was. And so when he arrived in the village, they presented him with a writ that said he could not enter the library. So 2 days later, Dan got some of us. And the brilliance of this plan was that it happened in broad daylight, because it would never work at night. But it looked like a maverick project, but basically we backed the garbage truck up to the library, and we took every single book in the library and hauled it up to Chalet 5, where Erlanders were living. And moved the library up and held it hostage for 3 days. And then there was a video that were shown at lunch.
That's one book.
Yeah, John and Mary Cram's Things That Make the Place.
What's the story of Larry's flag that was stolen?
I didn't know that one.
No. So, what's the country?
Yeah.
Liechtenstein.
Yeah.
He had a flag, and he was, I guess, the program coordinator for the summer, if I recall. And somebody took the flag, and he went away. He's got such great style up front, making announcements. He's marvelous. And it was gone, so he, after it didn't come back, he made the promise that it would be returned, unharmed, no questions asked. And if so, he would prepare a dinner, and he said what it would be. It was going to be, I think, some steak and this and that and all that other stuff. And, of course, then it came back, and he found out who had taken it. Oh, he said, but I forgot to tell you, what's the lake behind
Dole?
Dole?
The Dole. He's going to be served at Dole Lake. And he did. He did.
Understanding that Walt Bauman coined the word waitry, is that?
Oh, I don't know.
No, I don't think that's right.
No?
I've got the story of the novels, but I can't remember it. It was back in the 70s.
In the late 70s, maybe 1980, we ripped up the kitchen floor. And I think we were eating down here during that winter and starting to get it finished before the summer came, but when they ripped up the floor in front of the walk-in where a lot of food was kept, they found in it, and this story keeps getting exaggerated,
yeah.
But all sorts of little piles of food that had been stored by mice under the floor.
Oh, wow.
And, some was from the snack bar, and some was from the kitchen. And we knew that it had been around for a while because there were M&Ms and there were red M&Ms. During a time when there were no longer M&Ms, and now there are yet. But, there was all sorts of food, piles of food, and then after that got cleaned up, I think the next time it gets ripped up, people should know that there's a time capsule in there that 1980 staff put in that should have memorabilia from that year.
And in 1994, we remodeled the kitchen, but we didn't rip up the floor, but in the wall was an old bottle of beer that we think was probably from the mining days. And so we put that back in and put it in the 1994 bottle wall. So.
Well, the summer of 1984, they were re-roofing half, finished re-roofing half of the roof on Chalet 12, and so we had to have a ceremony to recognize that half of the roof had been completed, and they put a time baggie underneath one of the tiles, they put something in a baggie and put it under the tile. So we'll see another time capsule there.
I have one
one more on strangers coming in. When you mentioned the Renaissance thing, this was in the town was here. This was the Windows 81, and we were having a 50s dance. And everybody, all the men dressed up like the Fonz, you know, and they had the t-shirts and the cigarette packs rolled up on the, you know, laces, and the hair back and all the rest of these things. Anyway, the big dance, there wasn't much else going on around here in the, when the fog was here for 2-3 weeks and so on. So we were having an absolute blast. And Pell hiked in from the other side. He didn't even know Holden existed. And he came in and walked in, and here we were all. Spencer says, has anything happened out there lately?
This is a funny story, but I've been wanting to hear again, Elmer, the story about the El Salvadoran cross and who was involved with that, who created it. That was during your directorship?
Yes. It was through Dan, so he's got the better information.
Dan,
I'm going to call him and get credit for it. My understanding was done through somebody that Dan knew, whether he had met that person down there or in the cities, that he had them make the, I forget how many there are, tiles that came. They came in two boxes like this thick, and were delivered here finally. We waited quite some time for them. And then the carpenter at the time, who lives in Seattle now, and I have his name at home, made the cross itself. And I think it was Barb Rossing and I that stood in the balcony, and we laid out those tiles to see which ones would go where in the cross, and changed them around. We put them in, and it was put up. It was just part of the obviously ongoing peace and justice thing to have be connected with those people. And of course, and we paid them very miserably. I don't know why we didn't pay them more. We should have been had offerings for it. That paid them a small amount of money for their work. Yeah, but Dan gets the credit for the idea and for getting it.
Dan Erlander,
right, excuse me. Thank you.
I told this story to a couple people this morning, and reminded that in the back of, or next to Agape, I think it's still there, the old communication center.
Oh, yes.
That was started in, I think, 81. I think it was Werner Jansen had the idea, or somebody brought up the idea that Holden ought to have alternative communications if they weren't going to have telephones, and that they should start training carrier pigeons to carry messages up and down. And so the idea is that there would be two sets of pigeons, one up here and then another set down at 25 Mile Creek, that they would fly back and forth with messages. And so pigeons started getting trained up here in the spring of 81, and a guy named Ted Dale was in charge of this, and his job is to feed them and then train them, and they would be released every day, and they would fly around the village and then land on something, and after a while they'd come back to the pigeon coop and get locked up. And then after a while, we drivers would take them in down the road. And I remember the first day, I wasn't driving that day, but the first day that they took them all the way down to Lucerne, the story is anyway that they let these pigeons go, about five of them, and they circled three times like they were supposed to, and they landed on the bus and rode up. Successfully to Holden. I think one, they suspect that one of the birds was killed by a hawk, but then they thought another one had been killed because it disappeared for at least 2 months. And I remember at a staff meeting they announced that George had returned 2 months later with another pigeon from Canada.
had a tag on it from Canada, and so it was just flown off somewhere and came back 2 months later. Perhaps we don't have any words. Eventually that winter, some animals broke into the communication center and took care of the messengers. And it was very labor intensive to do the training.
When you talk about creating things, I've been wondering about who carved the door on the city sauna.
Oh, was that Hall?
Sobek.
Who?
I thought it was Sobek.
Oh, Sobek. I think
you're right. I don't think so. I think you did the only two.
Oh. It's a beautiful creation.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of the things that were made then were auctioned here so that we wouldn't start building up stuff that, you know, became stuff just to be here. It was to be used and then sent it on its way. Hmm. And I remember John Mockestead made those huge Christmas people. Are they still here?
Back there?
Yeah, those are some of them. And then there were shepherds in the field in Blaise that were what, a policeman, a nurse, other people who worked at night. And I know I tried to bid against a well-to-do dentist and, of course, lost for one of those. people.
How high did you get him?
Pardon?
How high did you get his bid?
Well, he went much higher. It just kept going on. I didn't. I dropped out early.
Oh, you dropped out early.
But that was part of the style was whatever was made was to be given away or for the benefit of the whole, the money would be contributed towards.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
We continue to have auctions. We had an auction this summer that benefit a group that gives loans to people in Nicaragua for starting new businesses. And there are two very creative, there's always very creative items brought to the auctions, like I'll go on a hike for you, take pictures, mm-hmm. and you can take the pictures home. those sorts of but the best ones of this summer's auction were a little 8-year-old girl sold the right to pull out her loose tooth. which I think was the bravest thing anybody did.
Oh.
Except for maybe this other fellow who sold himself along with the diamond ring he brought along. And he sold it to the young woman he brought along with him that on the trip this summer. He got up in front and they said, this is Dave and he weighs this much and he's got these degrees and this experience and he comes equipped with a diamond ring. So his girlfriend was in the back and she finally, the light bulb hits in her head. This is for me. So she bids $10 or something. Well, other people started bidding.
Oh,
wow. So she had to pay $65 for the right to come up front and have Dave kneel down on his knees and ask her to marry him. Oh. So we figured they'll be back every year for a long
time. One of the very fun things we did with young adults when we tried a couple years of just doing young adult ministry. We did a Stehekin all the way through one of the earliest ones, and Mert Strumma was here, a number of other people. And then the young adults wanted to do a serious hike. And I forget who it was who's leading Bible study and said, well, we ought to, while they were gone, it was the first time that most of them ever hiked and everything else, and it was an overnight and what all. And we prayed for them. We weren't sure they're going to make it back. But they ought to have foot washing when they come. And so we had people way out doing that. And we had, I don't know where we were. There wasn't any hot water. We had to heat the water somewhere. And then we all had them all sit along the, there was a ditch over here just next to the road, and had the tubs of water there. And it, and then we washed their feet. And, you know, their feet were pretty stinky. And it was amazing. The number that would not let you wash the feet.
No.
Yeah, it was really, it was in a very, you know, almost liturgical setting. We had prayers and we had reading of scriptures and washing of feet and all of that. But a lot of people, you know, they don't want to wipe with their feet in the first place, much less when they're so dirty. But it was highly organized. Runners coming in to let you know they're on their way, and all of that. And the water and some, I don't know what, Epsom salt water in the water. We worked at it. But I have some good pictures of that, of all those people lined up there. I don't think many of those went on hikes again.
Or they didn't go back.
Yeah,
well.
In 1975, we came up in the winter, and I built the bookstore. And, you know, I kind of thought that a simple thank you would be fine. But instead, they... the Hindus hung a cowbell around my neck, it made me a sacred cow. Oh. I couldn't find anything about that in the small catechism.
Well, that's a medical rule.
Well, being a newcomer, I have a question. This used to be called the fireside room, didn't it? I mean, where's the fireplace?
It used to be a fireplace.
Well, so is that all pretty clear? Was there a big hot electric? What did you say?
There used to be a huge hood that was about, if I stood there, would be high height.
Yeah. Be this hot and go all the way up to that vent.
Every night there were fires in there until it became, I mean, we were conscious of how much wood we were using, and in the winter it wasn't very efficient. It just let warm air out, and I don't know the other reasons, fire danger, the sight lines. It was, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to see Jerry now if that fire was, thing was there. So it really kind of interrupted people's view of each other. And so they finally took it out, and that's what remains.
We didn't have that room over there. This was the only room for education. Hmm. And the place was supposed to be focused on education. You had a room where you couldn't see people. And so that was one of the reasons that it, the last I saw it was under, what, four over here?
But some of those old tapes, you could hear the fucking one cracking.
And the way you started sessions was to bang in the
Martin has had a daydream or a dream, I'm not sure, about the fire ring here. Because in the wintertime, the community is small enough that we come into this room for worship. And so this room becomes really the center of our life in lots of ways in the winter, because it's where we have our community meetings, we have our worship, we have book studies, music, all kinds of things in here. Life is happens around this circle. It's still called a fireside room. But Martin had a picture in his mind of many, many years from now, and the village was gone. And some hikers came through, and all that they found was this stone circle in the middle. And they wondered, well, what is this circle about? But this was kind of what was left as a memorial. And I think, what a wonderful memorial of who we are, that this circle represents our life of worship, our life of community discussion, and discourse that we have in this place for all these years.
You know, this was a dorm like all the other lodges. That we just cut this out of it. And the fellow from Iowa was the architect. And he brought it in first. It looked like it was a terrible design. It didn't look like Holden, it looked like elsewhere. And he had to redo it, get the room to be so we could have a place together.
Well, thank you. This has been fun. And certainly continue your storytelling anytime, all weekend. This will be a big weekend for that. And again, reminder, we'll have that table up there all weekend for if you feel like just writing some stories down, and please put your name on them, and we're going to work on getting them transcribed and collected. And then we'll have also some oral histories being taken throughout the weekend. So,
by all means, reach out to the miners. They've got some gorgeous stories. They're lovely people. They love to share. And you'll be glad you did.
Yeah.
Thank you.